much as an example of recycling tonight as I am an expert. Part of the reason for that is that in doing our marriage communication workshops, I have been outlining the seven lifestyles that Jean and I have known since we got married in 1953. And we're embarking on a new lifestyle. We're leaving here on Saturday, and we have a board meeting on Tuesday night, and we don't know what's going to happen at that board meeting. All we know is that the school, as you saw it this evening, is going to be moved to another location. Our home is going to be moved to another location. We don't know exactly what character that's all is going to take place, and we've got a certain amount of fear with it, and we've also got a lot of excitement. So we're on the way, and we don't know what's beyond the bend. And that's possibly where a lot of you are at.
I suppose if there's any one passage of scripture that keeps coming back to mind, both in our daily lives and as we work, and especially as we work in the style which we have found effective and which you saw a portion of tonight. It's the part of scripture where Jesus says, "Suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not." And I think it's that little child part within each of us that allows us to continue to grow, continue to explore, continue to move from one aspect of life to another, regardless of what age we are. And when that little child part has been badly damaged or not given the opportunity to grow, then we still have built within ourselves through the divine, my own belief is through that divine wisdom of God, the ability to go back and reopen that little window in time and start anew that which may have either been crippled or stifled along the way. In some situations it has to be extreme, and in other situations it's much more free, but I think that's where we start. And from here on, I guess I'd like to just open the floor to the forum.
I'd just like to mention that the reason we use the term recycling people is because people have been, they've grown, they've molded, they've gotten to where they are, and they may have found a place where they don't fit, it doesn't work, and life has, for them, become meaningless. And in no way do we change people, but rather we go back to the very essence of life and build from that again. We don't take a personality away from someone, but rather we refine and take away the extra, the dross, the stuff that is burdensome and getting in life's way.
You know, it's kind of like peeling off those corns. You know? Or has anybody else ever had to do that?
We don't expect anyone to give up anything that's of value, but rather to evaluate and take a look at who they really are and what they really want to do. And this is where I see recycling as fitting into the whole program here at Holden this week in a very unique and very special way. As we have listened to Omar and as Mrs. Morris has made presentations, it's a single theme. So, I would ask for any stories that you might have or any questions that you might have, and let it be your form.
I'm anxious to know if there's any role that older adults, retired people could play in this, on a volunteer basis in this recycling program you some children need to go through the stage of having grandparent relationships or something like that. Is there some role there that could be played?
Thank you real much, because one of the things that we are looking for are parents and grandparents. My oldest daughter, chronologically, is 2 years younger than I am, and she has 8 children and 7 grandchildren, and it's just a little bit incongruent for me to be her dad, but nevertheless, it works. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of people out there that need parents. Their original parents aren't equipped to provide the kind of stability and direction that they need at this time.
And or even needed a long time ago. And that's part of the reason the problem's there today. I was saying to someone, you see, there's a whole bunch of us who have spent 20 or 30 years of our lives developing a whole lot of skills around being parents. And then all of a sudden, we're told we're not needed anymore. And that's not at all unlike the business executive who is suddenly told our firms have merged and your position is being wiped out and you're not needed anymore. And there's a great personal trauma for people for whom that happens. But more seriously, there's a great loss to our society, because we really are needed. Those skills are important. And there must be some way, there's some fledgling adult foster programs, foster parent programs being put together. But there's so much more. And I don't know what the mechanism is to get these two groups together. But I know that it needs somehow to be done, or there are going to be a lot of people ending up sitting out a lot of their lives in some institution that wouldn't need to be sitting there.
Or if not sitting out their lives in an institution, sitting out their lives in a rooming house all by themselves when they could be a part of an integrated family.
So maybe people here have some ideas of how we go about getting these this resource and this need together, instead of ending up, starvation.
Two years ago, our middle son was here at Holden, and I don't know of anything that really made a greater impression on him than being in this community and discovering the absence of the generation gap. And what he did was to volunteer for Lutheran Social Service for a year, and he was the person who got young people to live in with older couples, so that the older couple could stay in the house that they had bought and loved so much. And that may be one way of answering the problem and, in a sense, recycling. But there must be literally hundreds of homes where there are older people and they could use an extra pair of hands, with a great deal of benefit for everyone concerned.
But the great pandas, especially our Minneapolis chapter, has seriously started an intergenerational living situation for that very reason. And about 8 years or 9 ago, I discovered that this is something greatly needed, that since the three-generational family has been in most cases just wiped out, what I've seen in juvenile court was going up there for John Gilmore at that time, seeing parents asking themselves the same question: what did I do that I shouldn't have done? What did I not do that I should have done? And then when the kid comes out, how dare you do that to me? And the feathers flying, so to speak. However, and I've run this by quite a few youngsters, and once they were 18 and that magic birthday doesn't work, so they become adult offenders and I catch them in the jail. And I've run that question by so many of them. Do you think that at the time of your first being caught, if you would have had a pair of grandparents, either your own or maybe somebody else's, where you could have just planned to, instead of being exposed to your parents all the time, do you think you would be here now? In many, most cases, the answer would, I suppose not. And the ones whose personality was most destroyed, and I'm using that word deliberately, destroyed, were the ones who were left to parents, whether it was for whatever reason, no family counseling possible, or just not possible. And it never improved. And some of the youngsters, you probably know about that too, ended up in state hospital. Others are so-called hardcore criminals. No need. Grandparents are the necessity. And I feel, and this is in part what's behind the Great Panther ideas too, get generation one and three together. And that generation two heal somebody else's skilled health. Then get generation two and three together. And then, where there's a bond of understanding, accepting, and love, then get one, two, and three together. And I'm very convinced that what you are doing is exactly the same. And what the need would be to just screen people most carefully so that there's no mismatch, and it should be just a thing of the future.
I think a lot of what we're talking about is some education as far as what you are doing, and what does that involve as a grandparent. I know that when I talk to you about that or experience that with you, that it was just such an eye-opening thing for me, that I had no idea that something like this went on, and for me to try and explain to my folks what I experienced, they're very confused about that. So maybe it's an educational thing that needs to be sent out to people to say, here's what is required of reparenting. It's perhaps the skills that you have required, only now, like you say, Jean, you use it on a child that is now 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And that's, it's not a new thing, it's just something that we relive only when in different circumstances. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's some of that education that needs to go on. How that needs to be done, maybe it's a start here in our interest in showing up. Maybe some, I don't know what that, if I'm asking for an explanation or asking for questions, I'm not sure.
Are you asking the question, how does a person who has this feeling of, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, how did that person expresses initially accepting love and accept the fact, okay, you're a little child and that's okay. Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah, I guess, you know, for us to say reparenting, what does that involve? What would that take on our part? What do we show? What's the interest that we have to show or to love?
I know that for myself, what it means is that I am going to contractually enter into an agreement saying that I have these skills and this amount of energy, and within these circumstances, I am willing to share them with somebody who has certain needs and is willing to invest energy. There are certain, you know, if you're talking about the reparenting program, there are certain disadvantages and there are certain very real advantages. I think that one of the things that God has built into us is a knowledge of not only of a problem, but how to get a problem solved. I think that intuitively within each person, we've got all the know-how and all the skills that are necessary to get whatever it is resolved that needs to be resolved. And the key is how you unlock it. And so if that's true, then people's instinctual going back and getting little is part of that God-given gift. And people do that, severely ill people do it, and many treatment programs can say stop doing it. You know, when it seems to be the very thing that they know to go back to where the problem is and get it corrected back there. So the way we work is that we expect a person to help identify intellectually where it is they need to go and what they have to get fixed, and then contract for a specific length of time to get little and get those needs met in an appropriate way, and then to talk about it and share and do the normal give and take. I got a letter today from one of my reparenting daughters, and she said, the baby that you saw in the picture, yeah, is really our first grandchild. She's the child of one of our reparenting daughters. The letter I got today said, from this other reparenting daughter, said she'd gone over and visited Chris and Marn, and she said, Marn is really into the terrible twos, and I saw that it didn't take her too long to get distracted, so now I guess I'm ready to go back and take care of that two-year-old stuff myself that I've been so afraid of doing. And so I started to say there are some advantages and some disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is these are big bodies that you're dealing with, but one of the advantages is you can say to somebody, all right, the 2 hours are up, now cathect adult, and let's talk about what went on. And you don't have to be a therapist to do it. And believe me, that's an advantage. You know, some of you who've got little ones, or have been watching the little ones, I'll bet you that there are times you wish you could say, okay, get things down, let's talk about what you're doing. But it doesn't work that way. So that you don't have to be a therapist to do that. And then it's a matter of being willing just to share. Because many of these people are people who never got a chance to celebrate at Christmas. Never got a chance to have somebody go dress shopping with them. Never got a chance to go on a picnic and not have to be scared that someone was going to get angry or drunk or something. And so it's to share, have that openness, and then there's a lot of, there's so much that comes back to you in that process. Did that sort of speak to what you wanted?
Yeah, okay. More of the practical aspect of what does go on and what is required of us. It's not anything that, in this room there is a wealth of experience at parenting.
Yeah.
And if you don't have to be an expert therapist to do it.
No, there are those that are trained to do the other part. That's been, even for me, an interesting phenomenon with the school, in that I now have parenting contracts with a couple of kids in the school that I'm not seeing as a therapist at all. I'm just seeing them as a parent. And also with one of my other reparenting sons, who for a variety of reasons I'm not seeing as a therapist, but I'm maintaining a strong parenting contract with them. Anyhow, that's just one kind of recycling people.
I think you're assuming that most of us have more courage than we do, however. You know, when you were first asked, you said to have someone come into your home who was emotionally 2 years old, and evidently you even had your own children at home at that time, and you said yes. That's a rare kind of courage that I don't think most of us feel that we possess.
I think that's the word. There's nobody that ever grew up thinking they were as much of a coward as I thought I was. I think that most of us have more courage than we know we have, and I'm not even sure it takes a lot of courage. I think there are a lot of myths going on in our culture. It scares. You got the courage to drive on the freeway.
I think that probably one of the things that enabled us to do it was realizing that here was a person that we couldn't do anything wrong with.
It all been done wrong already.
What had been done wrong had been done wrong. And that what she needed was a stable place where she could emote, where she could act out, where she could, well, in her case, she was so retarded, would be the word that the physicians would use, that she couldn't raise her voice or swear. And she learned three things in the Lutheran parsonage: how to drink beer, swear, and raise her voice, among lots of other things.
Not that those have to be required to understand, but they were freeing. I'm sitting here feeling a little uneasy because I'm not suggesting people all rush off and do. You need a supportive environment, and you need trained people to work with you, but we're suggesting that there are all other alternatives for recycling people. Does that, you know, it's... We're not promoting the... In fact, when we do the workshops, we very carefully say to people, don't, you know, be sure if you're going to do this, you have a trained group.
And I'll bet that there are 50 stories in this room right here tonight about your intervening with people and giving them a new start. That's what we're talking about. And I'd like to hear some of those stories. Or maybe, who was it that stepped into your life and gave you the courage to start over again?
The story, I've never seen a tougher two-year-old when I first saw him. I mean, he had bounced around, and he scared me. He comes walking after. I had this image of this poor little helpless child that, you know, I was going to love and care him, and this kid comes out and scares me. I had another boy, who was also 2 years old. They were just 4 months apart. And, here we figured that we're going to love this poor little child, and here we're scared of it. But the thing was, is my other boy just accepted him. And we thought they'd have a lot of problems, and they'd fight with each other and all of this, but they accepted each other right from the start. And at the end of the first week, I mean, I was just horribly depressed because I was putting myself down for not loving this child. And then you stop to think about it. That's crazy, because it takes time, of course, to love someone. So if you are afraid, well, that may be a normal reaction. I mean, if you are uneasy with someone, well, of course, you haven't had time. You can't expect to just start loving these people, just turn it on like a switch. And I love my son dearly now. I truly do. But boy, man, that first time, I was scared. He was a tough little two-year-old. Of course, he was scared more than anyone.
Sure. He was acting out of a scare.
Not knowing
what else to do.
Yeah. And you can't expect to just flip a switch and you're going to love these people, because some
of them are. Or that they're going to be able to change. Yeah. Flip a switch.
Yeah. And it takes time. But it does take courage. I mean, what you've done really does.
A number of years ago, I got a telephone call. A woman who felt she did not want to come in. She just wanted to get some advice over the telephone. I was wondering, how did you get my name? Well, she had read an article about me in the newspaper, which read something like, jail chaplain is patient and understanding, or something like that. I forgot the exact words. And she thought that's exactly what she needed. She was not courageous enough to come and get seen face to face. I came within 2 weeks. I got to the point, I told her, all right, if you want me to help you, I'm afraid that we cannot carry this on over the telephone, because it just takes more time and it just takes talking with each other. Now, either we have to terminate this or you'll have to agree to come in. She was scared enough to want to come in. The appointed time came, the door opened, she stood there. You're Chaplain Joan? Yes, I'm Chaplain Joan. And it chose me like, you know, like you want to stop your skis. I'm not as clear, but I know that's the way it's done. And her shoulders were drooping. So please come in. She just walked as if she was automated. And we worked for about 2 years. First thing, I had to tell her, hey, your precious child and God. And a precious child of God takes a deep breath in God's air and stands straight. Finally got the idea that, oh, we tried a book on her head, tried the idea of your top of your head is fastened to a cloud that can't come down and rain. And taught her to walk. You swing from your hips and not from your knees or your ankles, and just gave her ideas. I am a child of God. Walk, do it, just be it. Took endlessly. Every time she came, it went this much on the path of improvement, always again and again. Came out that she was terribly abused. She couldn't do a thing right. Everything was her fault. Don't I know what it's like when everything is your fault? Maybe even the Battle of Hastings. Tried hard enough, you can't even hear the body. So I understood what it was like. And her husband was threatening her. She had run away once. It was a disaster. Her husband knew exactly she couldn't make it without him. She went back because she couldn't live without him. Although she made it much worse. So the next thing to realize was, don't advise to run. It's going to make it worse again. So build up enough confidence and enough, it's okay and it's very human. Yes, it's necessary and it's, no, it's not your fault and no, nobody can blame you for all those good things. Until about, oh, I honestly don't remember how many years it took. It was way, way back. But eventually we got to the point where she began to think seriously about her desire to go into an academic career, and her husband had told her, you cannot do it, you'll see. And he had set the children up against her. At that time I said, all right. And he had threatened her, pack an overnight case with just the necessities, and make sure you've got the second car key on your person. And if it becomes necessary, go. And don't call home. And let him work out with the children what he had taken. It'll backfire to him. Enjoy your freedom. And I mean, enjoy it. Because it's going to turn around. Fortunately, it never came. I wasn't quite sure of what I had said. But I knew if it wouldn't work, I'd help her to make it work. She not only went back to school and tried it, she graduated. Got a degree just a few days ago. I heard a very joyful shout behind me, Chaplain Joan, and turned around. There she was. In the meantime, she is embarking on an advanced degree, and she also told me that her husband is so amazed. He didn't know what to do with his new wife, and he helped her. He actually babysat. Nothing but just loving and nurturing them. With God's help.
Any other stories?
I'll bet lots of you know people who, for whom everything that goes wrong is their fault. Yeah, so are the rest of you. One of the people we work with lived for, oh, what? 20 years, maybe more, 30 years, believing she started the Second World War. Because the day that the war was declared, she was playing with the Ouija board, and she knew that that was an act of sin against God, and because the priest had said so, and so she knew that that was what had started the Second World War.
And she lived with that for 20 years.
At least. I don't know how long ago how long ago the Second World War started, but it was only about 3 years ago that she found out for sure that she wasn't.
Some 30 years. How did she come out of it?
It's been a lot. That's a long story, but But anyway, I'm just saying, you were saying, you were somebody who everything that went wrong was their fault? Mm-hmm. Not that some of the rest of us have known people like that.
The first 2 years she was in treatment, if anything went wrong, we simply said, it's Elizabeth's fault. And she said, I wasn't around, but I suppose.
Pretty soon she'd begin to see how foolish that was. That doesn't make any sense. And when it finally dawned on her was we were flying down to Kansas City, and she went in the bathroom and she flushed the toilet. And just as she flushed the toilet, the plane started to bank for landing, and she came out and she said, oh, I've let all the pressure out of the plane. And then she began to turn some of those other ideas around. So, you know, the 2-2 doesn't always make 4, even when you think it does.
Well, we have a fellow at work, he's a young fellow, and he adopted 3 children of the same family. He had 2 children of his own. And the one girl was about 14 when he got it. And they had been beaten and had been mishandled at home very badly. And he said it took a long time to really work with this. She might have been a little bit younger than that, maybe 12. And it took him a long time, but now she's turned out to be a beautiful Christian girl where he has worked with them and shown them especially love and that they are wanted. And she had even been told that, oh, she's going to turn out like her mother and be in an institution and things like that. Well, she has gotten over all of that now, and she is really... So you can work with even some of the younger people.
Do you feel like sharing with us the 7th cycle of your marriage? You told us that there were, so you kind of left it out.
Yeah, I think I can do it in a rather short time. I got married in 1953. I was a junior at the seminary, or I'd gone through 2 years at the seminary, so I was just starting my intern year. Jean had been out of Luther College for a year and had been down to Dallas for a bit as a parish worker and then come back to the cities. And it was during these 2 years during which she put hubby through and got her PhD that way, that we lived in a nuclear family. I was very concerned about student work at the time I was in the seminary, and I wanted to get into that in whatever way I could, and apparently the word had gotten around, so after my colloquium, the president of the church called me in and said, well, Al, the district presidents have decided that they will extend you one call, and that will be it, take it or leave it. And with that kind of a rather rigid ultimatum, we took it. And so we went to...
Especially Hamilton. Considering we had a baby due in 3 months.
We went to Halliday, Dodge, and Marshall, North Dakota. Now that's real movie country, if there ever is any. It's rough ranch land, and the first service that we had out there, when I turned around from the altar, I gasped, because all of the men were dressed in cowboy outfits, and the women wore calico. And the second surprise that morning was when I got to the door to shake hands. They all talked with such a thick Norwegian accent that I had to turn on my northern Minnesota brogue in order to even communicate. Well, it was a realignment situation, and I believe that the pastor ahead of me was somewhat ambitious, and so financially speaking, it was impossible for us to stay there very long. The banker who had put me all the way through college and seminary asked me one day how things were going, kind of the shalom sort of thing, and I told him. And he says, well, Al, I'll tell you, I'll give you $500 to move out of that town, but I won't loan you a cent to stay there. Mm-hmm. And so we left Holiday then for Makoti, which translated from the Indian as Mud Hut, North Dakota. That was another three-point parish with congregations 20 miles on either side of the railroad track. But we had an adequate salary, and that's where we raised our, we had two more boys born to us, and we pretty much got our feet on the ground. At both at Halliday and Makoti, we had high school girls living with us who went to school. So we had our extended families at that time too. 1963-62, we got a call to Rolock, Minnesota, and for those of you who know that particular parish, that's Steam Thrasher Hill, and the International Reunion of Old Steam Thrashers, the granddaddy of them all, meets right across from the churchyard. They have 120 acres there, and that's the big thing, and really it's the large part of the stewardship program in the church, too. Well, it was there that Gene decided to go back to school. And that left me with three congregations and three small boys. And it was part of my anxiety around that thing that said, let's get Peggy with us. And Peggy was the first person that we reparented.
He had so much anxiety that one time I came home from school and I said, how have the kids been? And he said, fine. And then I walked from the study into the living room and discovered Carl had spent the whole 4 hours hauling truckloads of sand in and making a sand pile in the middle of the living room floor.
The next lifestyle was at Wilmer State College, or State Hospital and Wilmer Community College. The boys were all in school, and I had a chance to have an internship at the hospital, such as has seldom been made available to anyone. Before I went to Wilmer, I had gone to a mental health meeting in St. John's University. And there was a very brilliant young psychiatrist there that was very helpful in describing certain things and giving us information. And on the Friday that we left, I held up my hand and said, now what are we supposed to do with this information? And the psychiatrist says, well, Al, where are you serving? And I said, I'm serving 25 miles from the nearest hospital, and there aren't any other professional people in the entire parish. And the psychiatrist said, okay, Al, you're it. Go home and do your job. I didn't realize until sometime later that I was actually serving a mentally disturbed congregation set out in the woods. At one time we had 8 people from the congregation. The congregation had only 110 baptized members, and 8 of them were in mental institutions. Those 8 were people that had left that little ghetto and tried to make it on their own side. When they came back into the little ghetto, they were accepted for their idiosyncrasies and functioned acceptably. But once they moved out, they were, quote, sick. Well, I hadn't been at the hospital more than about 6 months when there was a knock at the door. And a fellow came in and he says, well, Al, I'm here. I did a double take, and it was that brilliant young psychiatrist, and he says, I need what you got to offer. He was a drug addict, and we worked quite close for the next 6 weeks, and then he stayed on as the teaching psychiatrist at the hospital for 2 years. And that's where I got my basic training. After 6 years at the hospital, we took
By that time, I was teaching full-time at the college.
Yeah.
Then we switched roles.
So then we found this doctor's residence in Eakin and set up a private practice. Oh, what discouraged both of us with what we were doing in Willmar was that I was beginning to use transactional analysis and I was touching people and holding people, and the medical director would stop by almost every week and he'd say, Al, I just like what you're doing with so-and-so. But remember, if anybody blows the whistle, I can't back you up. In other words, I was doing things that were not, quote, kosher.
Like touching, like holding.
Like telling people that they were okay. Like letting them know that they were valuable.
And in the meantime, I was getting all the kids who couldn't make it in mainstream, and they were suddenly being able to make it. So then I had to discover what was going on and decided the educational system was doing more harm than good. And so I decided to leave teaching and got employed by the State Department of Education to go around and teach teachers, which was ironic.
And then we, the last 9 years, we've been doing our practice there in Eden.
I think that counts up to seven.
And starting Tuesday night, it's open.
Because the highway's going to come through and take our place, and so we're having to move.
There needs to be one more national flower. It can't be cloverleaf. And that will wipe us out.
But there are stories like that for each of you, where you have grown and changed and have more to offer now, and where things that seemed like roadblocks, or maybe roads, that are getting in your way, really aren't.
A closed door is an indication that there's some other place where you can put your energy. And one of my friends or mentors way back suggested, for every closed door, there are at least four that are going to open. Will you be ready for them? And will you dare take the risk? Not knowing what's at the end of the tunnel or around the bend of the river.
You know, you talked about the Great Panthers. One of the people we've talked about several times here this evening is Elizabeth. Chronologically, she's 55 years old. She's completely rebuilding her life. Age is no, the chronological age has no part of that. Neither being young, too young nor too old is any part.
What we need to, well, it's lies that make people crazy, and it's lack of recognition that keeps them sick. And the call, as I understand it, is to replace the lies with truth and provide a safe place for people to get recognition. And I'm convinced that when that's happened, people are going to find ways of loving themselves and others. As we've been talking here tonight, do any of you have some ideas as to what you're going to do different because you've been at Holden?
I think the word comes up strong. Just love for all ages, certainly for elderly and for the young ones, for our own and for others.
Know who needs it probably more than anybody? It's the mother with three preschool kids who's trapped or feels trapped with everything that she has to do. She doesn't have time or space to do it.
And that's where we grandparents can help out.
Yeah.
We can help to give them a day off. We can help them with a day of canning. we can help them just an evening out to the parents, just showing love. That can do a lot.
That means a willingness to risk.
Because you might do something wrong.
Right. Or what you do might not be received the way you expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times I go around thinking, how can they think those nasty things about me when I'm so nice? It doesn't work that way.
Or this worked for me, but how come they don't understand that?
Right.
That this sort of treatment that I still feel is right. But it's worthwhile sticking your neck out.
Al has a definition for love that has been useful for me. I don't know if you know.
Love is the attitude of heart in harmony with the will of God that expresses itself in action in the best interest of the other person without regard to what is done in return.
We need that up on the board.
That's been a real helpful one for me, because sometimes when you do something, it isn't always received. The person may be angry. If you make the intervention with with somebody who's chemically dependent, they may be very angry. You know, and still the intervention needs to be made, and is the loving thing to do.
You know, it's with all of these attempts and actions and whatever we do, it's just as with the word of God. It's His promise that His word shall not return unto Him void. And I think we are dead wrong. This is a terrible destructive society. Where on earth does the Bible teach us that we need to be the sowing of the seeds and the watering and the weeding and some more watering and the fertilizing and the harvesting? God has such a marvelous way of dividing it up. And if we don't reach somebody, does that mean that nobody's ever going to be reaching that person? I think we just have to do what God allows us to do. And if that's done, well, just sit back in the rocking chair and thank Him for this opportunity for 10 minutes and trust Him that somebody else will finish the work. With instant coffee, instant tea, instant news really from the other side of the planet, there is no such thing as instant people.
Have you ever had any relationships with your people in your house that have had to be terminated because of problems? Or?
Yeah, we have. We have one person who continues to use drugs. And we did what we could to facilitate his getting into a treatment program, but he refused to give up marijuana, and we had to terminate there. This spring, one of the people who's been has had a problem with being violent. Got violent in a situation where there wasn't adequate protection, and so for the safety of everybody, we said that he couldn't live at the house anymore, but he is continuing to be a member of the family and continuing a parenting contract with us. We knew that there were specific risks in beginning to work with him. The psychologist who did the battery testing for us warned us that it was probably one of the most violent people he'd ever tested. And we still chose to work with him and have for 3 years and seen some fine change, but not there. So that happened.
We're on a wait and see at the present time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And.
We had one adolescent that decided that she had enough evidence on us so that she would have us run out of town on the rail. And so she turned us over to the authorities. and it was pretty hot for a couple of days until the people who had arranged for her to come to our place took over, and then she was returned back to the school of detention, and within 2 days there she was in solitary confinement, and we ultimately were able to clear our names, but obviously she isn't back with us.
And the other person I mentioned is working hard at putting together a program in such a way with the hope that eventually he'll be back in the house. And we're waiting to see how that will work.
I strongly suspect that he'll be back with us shortly.
At least in the new house we're moving into, he keeps saying, which is going to be my room. So
now, the other thing that is real helpful for me is to realize that anything that is less than this is missing the mark, for which I need constant forgiveness. And if you back me up against the wall and ask Al, when is the last time you loved according to this definition, I would have to say I've never measured up. I approach it, but almost always I have some tinge of wondering what's going to happen in return. And that's my selfishness.
How have your own kids responded to this widening of the
Well, the person who in the film strip is called Jane, she's sitting on Joel's lap, and Joel and Eric and Carl don't really, but most of the reparenting kids, those that are really, there are different kinds of contracts we have with people who are reparenting. There's one group who become a part of our family, and they'll be a part of our family, and we'll probably be their primary family for the rest of their life. Jane is one of those people. And Elizabeth is another, I can go down the list. And there, the bond is very close. Then there are other people for whom this needs to be basically a therapeutic contract, and they need to get what they need, and we'll hear from them from time to time, and that has been the case anyhow. So anyway, Joe always introduces himself as number one son of the first edition. Eric was very angry and resentful. He was probably the most angry and the most resentful and the most openly bitter about the thing, the whole thing. And he is the one who is now over in India working in the cathexis program over there and intensively training, and worked at home with us for 6 months. I don't know whether that's Holden that turned him around or aging that turned him around or what turned him around, but he's now, he's come full circle in that.
If you can't beat him, join him.
And then Carl is the youngest. He is 21, he'll be 22 this fall. He is the biggest parent that ever walked around. And the person who I was talking about, who is so violent, I remember one time when life had gotten into an escalation and had run away from home. Now you got to remember, life is a man who is in the Marines for 3 years. He spent 7 years in prison. I mean, you know, this is he's chronologically, he's told me to stop saying he's 36 years old. He's 38 years old. He's 38 years old. He was 36, 37 at the time. And I happen to be driving along, and I see Carl, who's at that time 19, standing on the street corner and reading life out, and life is saying, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And, you know, so that's how Carl has dealt with it. He's just done.
Well, when Carl was about 5 years old, it caused almost a breakup in our home. But he crawled into Jean's lap and said, boy, am I lucky. I got two mommies. I got you and I got Peggy.
So it's from the very beginning, he has been in a different kind of position. He was three when Peg came to live with us.
And the day that Peg got married, the house was rather hectic, as you can imagine. She just graduated from college the day before and then getting married the next day. And it was kind of, emotions were running pretty high, and Jean was sharing in the escalation a bit. And Joel said, put his arm on Jean's shoulder and says, hey, Mom, forget it. Peggy's emotional. It's just a little bit more than usual, that's all. And for a 14-year-old to have that kind of an understanding about, quote, severe mental illness, I guess we've paid a price, but we've also reaped the benefit. And that's part of what we wanted to share with the group this last week. I recognize that...
There's been no more exciting, nurturing, rewarding kind of situation. It hasn't been a big thing in that respect. It's a group of people that are very, very rewarding to be with. And I suspect each of you, as you've shared, have experienced that kind of reward. People say, you know, how did you do it? Well, how'd you do it? You got so much more back than you gave. That's how you do it. And, yeah.
Do I understand that you set up your own family? You basically extended your family, and that's your...
Initially, that's what we did. We just sort of, yeah, the family just started growing. That was what happened. And when the person who's... Jane in the slideshow, she got little, and you can't send a baby out to drive on the freeway, so we took her up to the house and put her to bed, and she stayed for 5 years and grew up all over again. And then about a year and a half ago, we said, look, we've got all these skills and we've got all this information, now how do we extend it to a broader population? And then having extended that to a broader population, then all of a sudden we've got... It's like, you know, the circle. All of a sudden, now we've got more people, but now we need more parents who not have to use the skills that we've got, but just could help with the parenting, and then we can go ahead and... So we've got the school set up and that to build on the prototype that happened in the house. Yeah. We do need to stop.
Thank you so much for sharing and listening.
Thank you.